fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Good on KCPN 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and we've got the one and only Gavin Stone in the house today.
Thank you for letting me back in. It's been cold outside.
Well, you know, I like to see you with hard nipples.
Well, yeah. I normally charge extra for that, don't I?
Well, you know, we do what we have to. Listen, so you got a new book coming out soon too, don't you? Like, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So what's going on there?
So it's the sequel to The Unforgiven Spy, and it's called The Burning Spy, and it's just going through its last line of defense before we hit the go button now. So watch this space. I haven't got an official date yet, but I'll get back to you and let you know as soon as I know the date's going to go live.
Fantastic. What exactly? What body part is burning on the spy?
I can't tell you, but I can tell you there's cream for it to sort it out.
Well, you know, I like to check. I like to know what I'm getting into. In case I need to get the cream too.
I'll send you the prescription later via email.
Yeah, there's nothing like a good spy novel and a little bit of cream, you know. I just what a terrible person. Yeah, do you see that? Okay, now I have to say one thing before we get the guest in. This is crazy. Do you see the guy that just broke the world record? He's in the Guinness Book of Records. And what he did was he ate another 738 Big Macs in 2023 alone. So now he's ate a total of 31,238 Big Macs.
Wow. That is insane.
I know. Like, why would you? Like, could you imagine you break a record and you could, I don't think I would want to tell people this.
No.
Hey, guess what? I'm in the Guinness Records. And what did you do? What did you do? I ate 31,000 Big Macs.
Yeah.
But you know, that's two a day. He's eating two Big Macs a day.
Ouch. No, I don't think that's where I'd like to go. If I'm going to go in the Guinness Book of Records for anything, that's not going to be it.
Oh, and it's hilarious, too, you know. And so what he did to make sure he could get it to every day was he would go to McDonald's and order, like, 50 Big Macs and put them in his freezer.
Oh.
So think about this. So you've got a frozen Big Mac for however long before he gets to it. It's in there a couple of weeks. And yeah, have you ever tried to freeze a cooked burger and then heat it up in the microwave?
Yeah.
You know, the bun and everything's going to taste. It's going to be just nasty. Yeah. So, you know, I would hope that they would give him some sort of money, but you don't get anything for that.
No.
So.
Oh, see, you should have gone for Happy Meals. At least you'd have had the toys.
Yeah. Just like, boy, we know there's a sickness in the world right now when this is happening.
Yep.
But
up till then, the only thing I know about the Guinness Book of Records is that the Guinness Book of Records record for the most stolen book from libraries is the Guinness Book of Records.
Well, oh, of course you would know that.
I know. I don't even know why or how I know that, but, you know. What can I say? Alan, you always bring the worst out of me, and I'm talking about the Guinness Book of Records again. What can I say?
Yeah, I'm a dirty boy. Well, speaking of dirty boys, I've got an author here, and he's got a second book out here. It comes out today, and it's called The Underhanded, and it's Adam Sykes. So thanks for being here, Adam.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and be chatting with both of you.
Yeah. So listen, how many Big Macs have you had?
You know, I was thinking about that as you're talking about it. Somebody has definitely got to check his arteries because that is crazy. Two Big Macs a day.
I just cannot be healthy. You know, I and not even putting down McDonald's, right? I mean, but can it really be healthy? And wouldn't you get bored eating two of those every single day for years? Wouldn't that drive you crazy?
And I think the blood sugar would spike too, because there's a lot of bun there. It's three pieces of bread that's going on in there.
Yeah, there's something crazy. There's crazy people out there, you know, and I mean that in the most loving of ways. I just don't know what to do here. I'm just I'm going to go have a Big Mac. I'm getting hungry.
I'm wondering if he's mixing it up, maybe putting tuna on it one day and maybe kind of Jell-O the next day, you know, mixing it up a little bit and putting some different toppings and sauces on it. That, you know,
yeah, but, you know, he's not even – that's the hard thing is he's not doing it fresh every day. It's not like he's going out and getting a hot, fresh one, sitting there and eating it. He's putting it in his freezer and then eating them later.
Mm.
You know, I just, that bothers me more than anything. And I will say, he doesn't look bad. Like, he's 70 years old. He doesn't look like he's in awful shape. He looks in average shape.
He's 70 years old?
He's 70. Yeah, and he's from Wisconsin. So, there you go. But he looks fine. He looks, if you see him, you think he's totally a normal, average, healthy person. I would never have guessed. But, you know, so. When you write a book like The Underhanded, would you take characters that you've seen in places like that? Like, this guy's all over the newspapers and stuff the last couple of days and doing videos. They've got him, you know, of course, the media, they go out there and say, okay, well, here's a Big Mac. Bite into it and we'll take a picture. You know what I'm saying? So where do you get your characters from?
So, yeah, in The Underhanded, unfortunately, I guess I missed it. I did not include any Big Macs or any comments about fast food. I did have someone critique me once that I never had characters in the book eating, and they found that unbelievable that they could go through the whole book and not one comment about food. But for The Underhanded, as well as the other books I've been writing, they're all composites, I think, of people I've met. And for this particular book, the protagonist, William Dredson, who you follow throughout this book, he's a professor, and you first meet him in the south of France. He's licking his wounds. He kind of got a good thrashing in academia. But he's inspired by another professor I knew that I met later in life. But when we got to be friends, we were about the same age. Met him in graduate school. He had worked in orphanages during the Bosnian conflict back in the mid-90s. And so as I was thinking about this story, this gentleman who's my friend was kind of the initial foundation for what would be the protagonist.
Second book as well, so in other words, you didn't learn your lesson the first time. we all must be suckers for punishment, hey?
Yeah, you just got to keep going. Just keep putting your head down, and no matter how strong the salt gets in the wound, keep going.
Yeah, so what would you say when, like, with the are going to be the main differences between your protagonists, because you've got Mason Hackett in Landslide, isn't it? Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And William Dredson, what would you say, like, the comparing the two personalities are like? Are they completely polar opposites, or do they? Is there an overlap?
There's a slight overlap, but they are different. Landslide, the protagonist in there, like you said, this gentleman named Mason Hackett. He was a Marine Corps combat veteran from Iraq. He's really struggling on many levels with life, but different than Professor Dredson, the Underhanded. And Mason Hackett was kind of the result of three different manuscripts that never got published, and me having a very frank and productive conversation with my agent about there are certain things I needed to add. So Mason pulls back and delves into some of the darker aspects, I think, of, you know, post-traumatic stress or PTSD, people who can't forgive themselves about things they've done in the past, and somebody trying to find themselves in life, and yet also having this extreme loyalty to the people they've known over the years. And that's where that character came from. And a lot of the darkness in Mason comes out throughout The Underhanded. And it is a darker, grittier novel, more of the spy thriller realm because of the interaction with certain types of government agencies and eventually finding its way into the war-torn region of Ukraine, which I wrote before the Russian Federation invaded. Shifting to The Underhanded, I wanted to approach a character a little differently. So I had this, you know, professor in mind, because I'm a historian. I wanted to bring that into play. I wanted to bring, you know, historical conspiracies into play. So part of the plot for The Underhanded goes all the way back to 1870 and the Franco-Prussian War. And then I wanted also to show somebody who didn't have all the answers, who didn't have all the special skills, who couldn't jump out of an airplane or dive through the ocean or handle a gun or all these different things. And I think that is interesting for readers sometimes, because you throw somebody into a situation where they're unprepared for, and then you get to see how resilient they are and how they pick themselves back up and where can they go. And you don't know if they're going to make it or not.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Yeah, one. But could he eat Big Macs?
You know, he would have to pair it with a French wine from the Rhone Valley.
Oh, it'd have to be disgusting. Really,
it'd have to be really earthy to go with a Big Mac.
Boy, that's disgusting. Soak the Big Mac in the wine for a week.
I just dip it in, just have a bowl, and there you go.
Well, listen, you must have the story. Did you have the story first then, and then you applied the characters to the story originally?
So the underhanded, that evolved over about 20 years. And so when I joined the Marine Corps in the mid-90s, it was between, you know, the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and then it was between 9/11. And so that's when I joined the military. And at the time, the Bosnian War was the show. And we were going there as Marines. We were doing Mediterranean floats. We called them the 26th Marine Expeditionary Units. And I went over there twice. And so during that time, I got to see some of the horrors that were happening then with the genocide and a few other things. Flash forward, you know, a few years later or many years later, I now find myself in grad school. And that's where I met this professor. And we connected over our shared experiences back then in the 90s. I then find myself at the agency and I encounter a lot of extremists, groups in Eastern Europe. I can't talk specifically about how I encountered these individuals, but I got to see and experience what a lot of these right-wing extremist groups wanted, what they were trying to do. And so, you know, a few years after that is when I was writing. And I was trying to think about, well, what do I know, but what can I write about that's not going to get caught and, you know, blacklined when it goes through the censors, it's CIA when they have to review it. And so I said, well, I can take this historical conspiracy and these elements that I've experienced in life and weave this plot. And that's how it kind of came about. And it all just kind of fit together.
Do you think we're back in a Cold War again today?
Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt. We are definitely back in a situation of geopolitics where we are facing peer competitors. Some of them are adversaries. And they have global reach. And if we look at Vladimir Putin and his regime, they see the world in a zero-sum game without a doubt. So any advance, any, you know, benefit that the United States can achieve on the world stage is a threat to his regime. And he believes everything that he does needs to take us down a notch. And so we have this confrontational adversary with Putin and the Russian Federation. And make no mistake, they are not our friends. They are not our friends, and they do seek to undermine, put us down a notch, however they can.
Mm-hmm. And they certainly learned to use the different aspect now as compared to something in the 80s, let's say, is the social media. And they've certainly developed and used that very well against America, in a sense of there's a lot of people in America now that support Putin, think he's great.
Yeah, he's not a nice guy. I was in Moscow. I lived in Moscow for a year from 2000 to 2001, and he had just come to power. And I will say the tenor in the country back then and the perspective of the United States, there was some hope for Putin. He was younger. He was dynamic. He was a charismatic leader. There were a few things. But evidence has shown, his behavior has shown over the years that no, he's seeking to undermine us. And it's been widely reported all over the news about the activities they make in the cyber realm with social media, how they'll amplify certain issues that cause divisions here in our own country and other areas. And they're very aggressive about it. I mean, it's the joke now, the Russian troll farms, but those are real. And that is happening across the United States.
Yeah, I think Putin himself was Russian intelligence anyway, wasn't he? Was it GRU or FSB?
He was KGB, and then it transitioned from, you know, Soviet Russia into the Russian Federation, he was then in the FSB.
Mm.
And the FSB is his intelligence service. So if you think of the Russian Federation, you know, you've got the FSB, the GRU, which is military intelligence. Yeah. You've got the SVR, which is their external intelligence. He was FSB. And that's his service, which he's poured a lot of resources into and what he calls upon when he wants to do something sinister, like give somebody a plutonium appetizer or something like that.
I remember when my daughter was about 7 or 8, she asked me what the KGB stood for, and I said it was the Committee of State Security, and I've never seen an unusual look on her face like that ever before that day. It made me chuckle.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and the reason I kind of talk about it is when you're writing a spy espionage book or something like this, do you have to be careful on where you go with different countries and different leaders and different sort of geopolitics and stuff because of the times the way they are now? And not only that, things seem to change real quick too, you know. So are you hesitant on certain things?
I think for me, thinking back to the books I enjoyed reading in my childhood, what I grew up with, either with Tom Clancy or Robert Ludlum or Jean Le Carré and all these great authors out there, and the books I read now as an adult, the books I have found that I have enjoyed, although they might touch on current events or real happenings, they don't try to get into the nitty-gritty and be very specific and detailed, either trying to predict the future or trying to, you know, enmesh themselves into a current event plot with your protagonist running around. Because oftentimes I think, you know, those books aren't tracking with what's really happening in the world. So if somebody wants to, you know, if I'm reading a book that's a historical fiction, yeah, I like it interwoven with that main event. But I found the contemporary books that I like to read, they may touch on current events, but they are also an escape. And so it's not like I don't feel like I'm watching the news and saying, oh my gosh, this is happening right now. The book I'm reading is happening on TV. I like to read, oftentimes for escape. If I wanted to read about current events, I'd pick up a nonfiction book. So with my own writing then, although I will touch on maybe a theme that is noticeable in, you know, with current audiences, or maybe a theme that would have been noticeable years ago, I do try not to identify or go straight after or include a lot of material about somebody like Putin. I'll talk about the Russian Federation, but I'm not going after somebody specific, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
I love it when you can pick up like what I call evergreen books, where you can read it and it could have happened at any point in the last 30 years. You know, you just it doesn't matter. It's not dated. A lot of the books now you kind of pick up and it's all, there's so many current events in it that in a couple of years' time you go back and read it and it's not going to be as readable as it is today. So changing the subject slightly, Adam, I'm going to just kind of get to grips, because obviously William Dresden is based down, you said, in the south of France. In all truth and honesty, was this just an excuse to go down to Monte Carlo for a while?
I got to spend 10 days in Monte Carlo on my honeymoon, and it was a great time. I loved it. If you've ever been over there, it's a great place to go. I will say this. We brought all our, you know, we brought our tuxedos and a nice gown because we were going to go to the casino. Mm-hmm. And the first night we went there, thank goodness we were not dressed up. It just had on like a jacket and a tie. And we walked in there, and we were the most overdressed people in the entire casino, besides for the staff. There was T-shirts. There was shorts. There was, you know, tank tops,
yeah,
flip-flops, and people at the craps tables or, you know, playing blackjack in a very casual atmosphere. It was nothing like what I expected reading James Bond growing up. I expected to be handed a martini when I walked in and, you know, be given a coat because my coat was off the rack. Maybe it didn't fit right, to be switched out so I could fit into the crowd. it was wonderful. It was very elegant. But that blew me away that we were so overdressed and all I had on was a tie.
Those days are gone, boy.
Yeah. I remember many, many years ago, my dad went to the casino there, and this is back when £100 used to be a lot of money, and he went to go and get some chips, and he went over, and he kind of handed the two £50 notes over, and the guy slid him a singular chip back, and he looked like, right, he was kind of expecting a bit of a stack, thinking, well, yeah. So his entire £100 went on the roulette table on one number and disappeared and vanished quicker than he bought it.
I think I hit my limit. I was done at the blackjack table in 5 minutes, and that was fine. It was just an experience.
that's what my dad said. He said, at least I can say I gambled in Monte Carlo.
Well, I love France. I lived there for a while, and I really enjoy the history. I love the food, and I was joking earlier about Rhone wine, but that's actually my favorite wine region in the entire world. And I've got quite a collection that I love to enjoy. So that's kind of why I picked that.
Oh, very nice.
Right. I really like Nice. I was there for a while. I worked in Paris for a while, and I went down. Nice was my favorite area around there. I don't know why. I guess because it wasn't, you know, the gambling thing. When you write a book like this, and you're an espionage and spy and thriller and stuff like that, I would expect that people want some sort of a subtext, a meaning, some sort of a reason under the story. Like there's a reason for the things that happen. Do you actually put in a subtext in the story?
I try to. Because those are the types of books I like to read, you know. I like there to be something that makes me think. And when I finally get to the last page, I you know, sit and marinate on it for a bit and, you know, try to figure out what was trying to be said or illustrated. So I try to do that. I would say whether I'm successful or not, we'll have to find out when the book comes out if people think so. But certainly with spy thrillers, I think there's some common themes and stuff about, you know, duplicity and trust and being double crossed, and then how do you wade through this morally ambiguous mass of stuff that's confronting you. And I did try to do that with The Underhanded. I mean, the protagonist, Professor Dresden, he has to grapple with the fact that his entire life, his entire family is not what he thought it was, and it's actually very sinister. And how does one come to grips with that? And then how do you move beyond? How do you view yourself? What do you think you're going to do next when you find the facade that you thought was your identity has been torn apart? So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is, coming from my experiences in the intelligence community, you never know if somebody is genuine or telling you the truth. If you're, you know, your colleagues, obviously, you know, you have to trust them with your life. But when it comes to engaging with assets or foreign partners or targets that you're going after, you never know if they're telling the truth. And what I mean by that is, over years, sometimes over decades, if you've interacted with somebody or worked with someone, something they told you 10 years ago that is still pertinent to today, is that a truth or not? Because it is a game of lies and deceit. And everybody has an agenda. And how do you work through that? And the people that you think are your friends, are they really your friends? And the people that you maybe like, is that a front? Are they trying to get something at you? And even maybe your enemies that you worked with for a time because you had a common interest. What was genuine? What was not?
Right. But how do you get out of that? Like, you spend all this time in that kind of a job. And I know I talk to a lot of cops and detectives that spent a lifetime doing that, or 25 years. And, you know, their spouses will even say, yeah, I hate going to the store with them, because we go out and they're always looking for people stealing or doing things. Like they're in that mode, even though they've retired. And do you find that same sort of thing now? Are you still spy working in your mind and suspicious of, you go to the grocery store and you're watching everyone, you know?
Yeah, I think Gavin probably has similar stuff. Even though I'm out of that world, I'm nowhere near it now, I still have some of the same habits, perspectives that I would have had. They're not as extreme. I worked in some pretty hairy places. And, you know, there were some nights where I would sleep in the closet because I didn't know if somebody was going to be come kicking through the door or something like that. Or wondering, you know, wherever we might have been sleeping, if I was with another individual. I remember one place we were in East Africa, and we were genuinely planning, okay, if something goes wrong, how are we going to get out of here? Well, we got a can of diesel, so we're going to pour that down the stairway, and then we're going to light it with an incendiary grenade. And once it starts smoking good, we're going to jump out this back window here because we can get in the alley. And those are the things I'd fall asleep to. And so now I live in Southern California, so I'm really not thinking about burning up a stairwell. But when I,
so you say,
you never know. Like I said, you know, you never know if somebody's telling the truth or not.
Yeah.
I still find myself being cautious around certain people, and there are certain indicators when somebody will or won't say something or their behavior that'll pique my sensitivities to stuff. And I am cautious. I try to control it as best I can. There's definitely an element of being comfortable with ambiguity and uncertainty. And that is a key quality, character trait of being able to be a spy, to conduct espionage, because you're never going to have all the answers. And there's always going to be an unknown. And you just got to be comfortable with it. You got to be calm with it. And you got to be able to react, respond, and recover quickly.
I'm actually, I've got that much into the habit of teaching my daughter tradecraft. And yeah, like you say, I don't think you completely grow out of it. No matter where I go in the world now, whether it's Israel, Europe, Africa, if I stay in a hotel, I still to this day carry a rubber door wedge with me that goes in every hotel.
Exactly. Yeah. A little door wedge.
Yeah. So, Dresden has a associate on this one, Adeline Parker, who is MI6. Now, I know we were talking yesterday, and so I know you've kind of worked with MI6 previously. Was she based on somebody you've worked with, or is it a mixture of people, or is this somebody fresh that you've invented from your own mind?
She's you, Gavin. Gavin and I secretly met 10 years ago.
Yeah, I am. I don't have that dress anymore.
She's a composite. She's essentially a composite of two different people. So that's what she came about. And these are two different people I met in very different points of my career. One of them was somebody I worked with in a war zone area, and the other one was somebody I worked with in Europe. And I tried to blend that together to create this person, Adeline. Now, her backstory is completely made up. But I needed to get something. I needed to have her have a backstory that would give her the motivations to do what she was going to do. But her personality, her intentions, her toughness, all that, you know, comes from these two individuals.
Do they know who they are?
No.
Okay, so we'll leave it at that then.
Yeah. He'd tell them, but he'd have to kill them.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's MI6, so I mean, I might be the one who's outnumbered if there's two.
So there's this whole experience, like, because we talked about how, you know, your years and that kind of service has still, it's still part of who you are. It's still part of your actions. So when you write a book like this and you put the time into it, year or however long it took you to actually get it out, plus all of your history, when you do this, does that experience in itself change you?
I think it does. I enjoy the writing process. I enjoy the process of coming up with the idea, the process of solitude, where you're putting pen to paper, and I do. I still write with a real pen and a real notebook before I transfer it to a computer. The editing process, the back and forth, the story development, I enjoy all that stuff. And I get up really early in the mornings. You know, Gavin and I yesterday, we were speaking, it was 5 a.m., you know, for me when we were on the call. And that's my normal wake-up time, because that's when the house is quiet, it's still dark, I've got my coffee, and I can write and focus. And the reason I try to do that in the darkness in the morning, and I also come up with ideas when I'm running. You know, I think best when I'm moving. So I'm a runner, and I'll go on these long runs if I'm trying to think through a scene or something. But all this is to say, as I'm writing a novel, it's changing me because I find myself exploring my experiences and stuff I've encountered in life that I don't yet understand, or maybe have come to grips with yet. And I don't know, for some things, I don't think I'm ever going to fully understand or, you know, come to grips with what happened or what I did or what others did or what I saw or didn't see. But through this writing process, I'm able to explore areas that I don't know how to in another way. And as I explore these areas, I know there are other people out there who are doing similar things where they're trying to figure out what it all meant, what they did, or maybe something completely irrelevant, but just something impactful in their life. And hopefully, as I, you know, show these ugly parts of who we are, as well as the good parts, that it'll resonate with people and they'll find themselves enjoying the story and being drawn into it.
Yeah, I could totally connect you there for a moment, because I felt the whole process for me really, really, it was like a form of therapy. You know, and so, you know, did you find it like a therapeutic process, kind of like almost letting a lot of the hidden things that we can't talk about, you know, kind of form into words on paper, so that, you know, as a form of release, as it were?
Absolutely. And it was a form of release that could be very raw in its draft format, mm-hmm. but then I could clean up if there were elements I didn't want to yet expose myself to the world with. You know, I did 25 years in national security, you know, 10 years in the Marine Corps, about 15 in the agency, and majority of that was in combat arms and in special operations capacity, in the intelligence community. So I've seen a few, you know, bumps in the road over the years. And, you know, I'm open about that. You know, I've had to, you know, chat with a few counselors at times to come to grips with this stuff. And the best advice a counselor gave me once was, Adam, if you weren't changed or different by the stuff you've experienced, then something would be wrong with you. And you're the type of person that doesn't need to talk about it in a group. Some people do, some people don't. But you're very internal processing. And so being pressured to discuss it in these other forums is actually going to have a negative impact on you. But in your writing, you have found a way to address these things and confront them. And you can do it on your own terms. So that's how I kind of look at it.
Yeah, I like that. I'm taking over a little bit here, Alan. Sorry. I was just thinking about a post I saw on social media that said, my therapist told me to write letters to all the people that I hate and then burn them. I've done that, and now I don't know what to do with the letters. Oh, come on. I had to get one cheap, awful joke in there. That's a dad joke, I think, isn't it?
I tell you. So what happens to these counselors after they see people like you and Gavin? Do they just disappear?
If they've got any sense, yeah.
Probably shaking their head and open up in a bottle after that. Yeah. Out of the conversation. Oh, my God.
Say the things I do for money.
Yeah, the last thing I said to my counselor was, how does my lack of progress feel to you?
Yeah, and then you shot it, right? Yeah. So how do you see your characters? Like, do you actually hear your characters? We get a lot of writers that do these sort of stories, and do you actually experience them as people, as friends, as that sort of thing, and you create dialogue from what you hear, or do you have a different experience?
I do. I do see them. I hear them in my mind as I'm trying to develop it. And when I go back through and do the rewriting process, there are definitely times I'll come up across a string of dialogue or internal thought, and I said, there is no way this character would ever say that. They would not speak like that. You gotta fix it. But one of the things I do to make it more real for myself is when I'm in the editing process, I read it out loud. I'm doing that right now for the sequel to Landslide. I'm kind of through the writing process. So I just read it out loud to myself as I'm going. Now, it takes a while because, you know, I'm speaking at a normal pace, but that allows me to hear the tone, the passion, the perspective of an individual character, and to say they would or would not talk like that. And I also, I think, have connected characters to real people in my life, and so I'll hear that person who's a real human being, I'll hear their voice or their tone with certain phrases. And that's what I try to do with these characters. Hopefully they come off the page and seem genuine to the readers.
Well, you don't, like, walk down the road or hang out in the mall and start talking and doing the dialogue, do you?
No, I stopped talking to trees and walls a while ago. I got confronted by the police. No, I didn't sit the confines of my office where I have this one window where I can look out over a wall at the blue sky or rainy sky.
See? Hey, so why did you choose to go into writing? What happened to you? Who hurt you?
You know, when I was young and a teenager, probably when you're at the most confused stage of your life, that's when I had the clearest vision of what my future was going to be. And I was going to be a Marine. And so as a teenager and I was growing up, all I knew that I wanted to do and I focused my life towards was becoming a United States Marine. And then I did that, and the first day I'm going through basic down at San Diego, within the first hour, I'm thinking to myself, what did I just get myself into? But it was good. I had a great 10 years, but I learned maybe about 5 years in that I wanted to go do other things. The Marine Corps was great, but I wanted to do other things. But then 9/11 happened, so I hung around for a few more years because had to give my service for that. But then I got out, went to school, and I was planning to either go into corporate banking up in New York or become a foreign service officer, a diplomat. And in the course of that time is how, through chance and a few other reasons beyond my control, I ended up at the agency. And I was there for 15 years. But it went well. And so what I kind of think about a lot of my life is I've seen opportunities or seen things that have inspired me. And I followed that path, and I've been very fortunate enough to still be standing upright on this earth. So when it came to writing, it started about probably a little over 10 years ago. I'd always considered myself a writer, but if you had talked to me 11 years ago, I probably would have said, yeah, if I'm going to write a book, it would be nonfiction. I'd wrote academically, I'd wrote professionally, that was where it was. But I'd been a very voracious consumer of fiction. I can tell you some of the first books I ever read in elementary school about authors, whether it was Ludlum or Stephen King or Clancy. I know exactly where I was when I picked up some of these books. But 10 years ago, I had an opportunity. I was still in the agency, and I had a bit of time ourselves. I was with one other gentleman, a SEAL, and we were waiting to do an operation. And I'd already read through the entire series of Game of Thrones. I've already watched every episode of Big Bang that I brought with me, and we were confined to this one area. And that's when I started playing around with a scene. And originally, it was just a bit of enjoyment. But what I found was I really, really liked it. And then I kept with it. And through a sequence of events, I got to work with a fantastic developmental editor, Richard Merrick, the late Richard Merrick, who happened to be Robert Ludlum's editor for The Scarlatti Inheritance and his first 10 novels. So I got to work with him for about a year. And just the sequence of events, I ended up with an agent and went through a few more manuscripts. And what I found was at this stage in my life, after everything I've done, this is what has really inspired me and what energizes me to wake up in the morning. And I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can, as long as I can see, as long as I can hear.
As long as you know who you are.
That too. That too.
It's the pills keep working.
Yeah, well, yeah, I did get hit by an IV a number of times, so I do have some memory issues, and sometimes it's problematic. But
so how much would you say you've grown as a writer since, like, kind of first putting pen to paper at the beginning of Landslide to now coming to, you know, another book and then writing the sequel to Landslide? Would you say you've, like, really evolved as a writer in that journey, and in what ways?
I feel I have. Now, whether the readers will think I'm a better writer or not, you know, that's up to them to decide. But I know the first manuscript I wrote, fortunately, will never, ever be published because it was atrocious. Couple of the comments were made, your dialogue is wooden, and a few other very apt descriptors of what it was. But what that taught me was where I need to improve. And I'm one of those folks that if something is not good, you need to use those words. Tell me it's not good. Don't sugarcoat it. Don't beat around the bush. Don't try to protect my feelings. Mm-hmm. If something stinks, you need to tell me how bad it stinks. Because if you don't, I won't know where I need to get better or evolve. Now, it's up to me to take that advice and take that guidance to apply it to my craft. But from the first manuscript I wrote to Landslide to what folks are going to see with The Underhanded, yeah, I think there's been an evolution. And now I find myself really trying to focus on particular elements of the craft that I read in other writers, because I'm a very diverse reader. You know, like I said, I've read Stephen King and Clancy, but, you know, Margaret Atwood is one of my favorite authors. Amor Towles is one of my favorite authors. Hemingway is, Graham Greene, Charles Cumming, John le Carré. I mean, these are, you know, these are some amazing writers with just some spectacular skills. And so I look at them and I try to read and see what they're doing and how they're evolving their plots, how they're pulling out the characters and how they're making the issues that they want to address. Not on the nose. It's not hitting you on the forehead saying this is exactly what's happening, but you realize it over a couple hundred pages. And that's what I'm trying to do now.
Stephen King. Let's see. I've heard his name a few times. Does he write books?
There was a tweet, wasn't there, with Stephen King, where somebody was on about COVID and said, is this like The Strand, or the book The Strand? And Stephen King replied with, no, it's nothing like The Strand. And she turned around and said, how would you even know? Have you even read that book?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny, actually.
I remember where I was when I read his read my first book, his Eyes of the Dragon, which was he wrote for his son, and it was geared towards a younger audience. And I remember I was living in Burlington, Mass, right outside Boston, and I'd gotten the book from the public library, and I know where I was in my parents' house when I was reading that and just loved the book. And I thought he was an author that wrote all kinds of books for kids. Boy, was I wrong when I got the next one.
What?
That was a wake-up call.
Oh, it was. It was. It was very disturbing.
You know, Gavin picks up your book, takes it home and reads it. What is it you hope that he gets out of it? What do you hope the reader takes away from The Underhanded?
The first thing I hope is some entertainment. I mean, ultimately, I spent so many years in national security in a very challenging environment where there was not necessarily a lot of enjoyment. It was rewarding. It was impactful. It was of value. I wouldn't trade any of it. But there was definitely a different world. So now, with writing, what I really hope is that when somebody picks up one of my books, they feel entertained, and they feel like they've gotten to know some characters and had some enjoyment in their life. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is I love history. And so what I took with The Underhanded was I tried to take the threads that are common throughout history. You know, if you're a student of history, you'll know that some of the challenges, some of the issues that that the world has faced over the centuries are still evident today. And there are connections. You know, we are who we are because of what's happened in the past. And so with The Underhanded, I tried to show that some of the challenges and some of the events that occurred in the 19th century in Europe really were the precursors and the threads that connected to some of the major events we saw in the 20th century, whether it was World War I or World War II and the Nazis and, you know, the Cold War, and some of the stuff we're seeing now. And it's not about current events or anything like that, but to see that, oh, there's these connections. So part of it is that entertaining engagement of a plot that draws you in. And then there's the characters. And getting to know a character and their background and how they interact with people and their personality. I hope people come away with the idea of what I was trying to convey. Hey, this was a good character. This was a complex character. This was not a good person. And then have them think about, oh, what's going to happen next with them.
I've got to ask, when it comes to writing an antagonist, how do you deal with the challenge of that, of like kind of, but making that antagonist somebody who you've got to make them a deep quality character with a good backstory. I mean, where do you go for inspiration for that kind of thing?
Unfortunately, I've met a lot of bad people in my life. So some of it is that. I mean, there's some really bad people in this world. And so some of it may have come from that. But again, I try not to get too close to current events, and definitely try not to get too close to real people. I look at, having known the horrors that we as people can inflict on each other, whether that was what I saw in the Balkans or the events in Iraq and, you know, elsewhere that I've been, either in Central Asia or some of these other very challenging places of the world, would take some of that. And I don't want to get too dark with these individuals, because I know I don't particularly care to write that. Again, I'm writing for enjoyment and entertainment, but you've got to tease some of the evilness in these characters to make them a worthy adversary to go up against. And what I try to do also, and I'm not sure if I've been successful yet, but also to create in these villains something that will, that a reader or the audience is going to see and maybe like about them or accept about them. Because, you know, there's very few pure evil people out there. People have good and qualities and different perspectives. So how do you do that in a novel to make it interesting, where this is clearly the bad person, this is the villain, but they're not all bad, and maybe they have some redeeming qualities. And then that, I think, allows a reader to enjoy the book, because they're connecting with multiple people in different ways.
Yeah, there's nothing better than a good bad guy. I mean, I love things like the Sheriff of Nottingham. I think he did a brilliant job. What was his name? Alan Rickman, wasn't it? Who played the Sheriff of Nottingham?
Oh, yeah.
He did a brilliant job. And then so many others. I love the comical bad guy, as it were. But somebody who you kind of like can relate to at the same time. So, have you learned your lesson yet and put yourself at a bedside, a nightstand kind of notepad and pen, or are you one of these people who says, "I've got this brilliant idea for the book, but I'm too tired to move, and I'll remember it in the morning"? Then wake up in the morning, have your coffee, and go, "What was I thinking? Thinking I'd remember it."
I am. I always have a notebook with me. I always have a pen with me for that exact reason.
And me.
So I got one beside me at bed. I carry it with me throughout the day. If I'm out running or exercising or hiking and I'm all sweaty and I don't have a notepad, I use my phone. I am known for, if you've ever been out to California in LA, Griffith Park, and the Hollywood sign is up top there. The Griffith Observatory is up there. That's one of my favorite trail runs. So I'll start at the bottom and go up, which is a really, really good run. I enjoyed it. It's a couple hours. But I'm not going to be able to take a notepad up there, so I will stop mid-run when I'm thinking about something and type something in my phone so I don't forget it, because I'll plot a scene as I'm running. But, yeah, I always keep that notepad and book with me, because I know my memory will not remember in the next morning. I've got two young kids, so I'm lucky I remember to eat lunch half the time.
So there's more text messages off yourself than anybody else than on your phone. So you seem to operate like me, where you kind of, you do something and you think about what's going to happen next and then go and type it up and then go and maybe do a run or lie on the bed or mow the lawn or whatever the case may be, then go and I found that my wife's coming to me on a couple of occasions, found me lying on the bed, and she said, "I thought you were writing." I said, "I am." She said, "No, you're lying on the bed." I said, "No, I'm writing it in my head. And I'll be typing it up in a half an hour." is that how you operate, or do you tend to have more of an overall plot and you know where it's going to go before you've even pressed the first key?
No, it's definitely that. I write it in my head beforehand, and then I'll take a note down, very much chicken scratch, and then I'll write it out and flesh it out. I know where I'm usually going. I am one of those people. I know where I want to go, so now I just got to figure out how to get there. But half the time as I'm figuring out how to get there, I end up going a different direction, which is okay. I do like to plot it out in my head and then let the words come out that way.
Brilliant. And if you could inspire any future writers out there, what would be the best piece of advice you could give them?
Just get up and write. And I know that's so simple. But I do think Hemingway said it best, and I'm going to butcher the quote, but he said, "No matter what happened the day or the night before, get up the next morning and bite on the nail." And what he meant by that was get up and write. No matter what's going on, no matter what's happening, no matter where you are, the only way to be a writer, the only way to write is to sit and write. Don't wait for the inspiration. Don't wait for that moment where everything gels and you have your muse and everything is perfect. Just start writing. Even if you have writer's block, just start writing nonsense and you will break through that. And you will find that what you start writing with, no matter how good of a writer you are, you're going to rewrite it anyway.
True.
You're going to rewrite it anyway. I know the books that I write, the manuscripts that I write, the first draft I have, I just wanted to get it on paper so then I can go back and fix everything that I know I was, doing wrong through the first time. But you've just got to get that first word down, that first sentence, that first page, and just keep going.
Yeah, perfect is the enemy of done.
Yes.
There you go. Yeah, you just sit down and bite the Big Mac.
Exactly, yeah. That could be the new one. That could be the phrase of today, the frozen Big Mac.
Oh, boy, that's nasty. So listen, social media, website, how do people get a hold of you to let you know how much they liked your book?
That's wonderful, and I hope they do let me know how much they liked rather than how much they hated, although I love the negative comments, too. So my website is adamsykes.com, It should come right up. I'm also on Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, and Threads, and Facebook as well. If you type in Adam Sykes or Adam R. Sykes, you'll be able to find me on all those. And I have a newsletter called The Black Cash that I write about not just, what I'm doing, but also what's going on in the thriller mystery genre and, you know, other authors to check out. A lot of the folks in the writing community I've become friends with, which I've genuinely enjoyed, you know, like you gentlemen right now. I'm glad we've talked a few times and I'm looking forward to future conversations. So I like to talk about what else is going on in the industry and then talk about also fact and fiction when it comes to things like spycraft and what really happens in the world of intelligence.
Yeah. And you're going to be at Left Coast Crime here on April 11th to 14th, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm very excited for that.
Well, I'll be there. Joe's there, and I think John is coming as well. So there'll be three of us from the show.
That'll be wonderful. Love to say hello and maybe have a drink together.
At least one. And a Big Mac.
There we go. Yeah. I may show up with a Big Mac.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm buying. Big Mac. Well, so what's next? What do you got going on now? What's going on behind the scenes?
So I've always got something going on when it comes to the writing stuff. I think I may run out of years before I run out of stuff I want to write about. But in the immediate future, desperately trying to finish the sequel to Landslide. I'm finishing that up right now. I've started writing the sequel to The Underhanded. And I do want to comment on it. I do some developmental editing on the side. And one of the books that will be coming out in the next year is about JFK's architect. So this gentleman named John Carl Warnicke, at the time in the 60s and 70s, had one of the largest architectural firms in the world. Anyway, it's his life. He has since passed away, but his daughter has been crafting his memoir, and hopefully that'll come out this year as well, which will just be a phenomenal book. I mean, it is a fascinating life this gentleman lived. Is an intimate of the Kennedys and everything he did after. But that's kind of what I got going on right now.
Well, fantastic, you know. Hey, you know, and if someone does give you a bad review or something, you've got the know-how how to find them. Hunt them down.
I think some people, I always get a kick out of it when an author takes their bad reviews and they kind of, they promote them on social media or something. It's all the bad ones they got, which are quite humorous sometimes.
Yeah, it's funny. I know there's one author, he sits in his tub drinking wine and he reads them on social media. Like he'll read a couple. I think that's kind of funny, right?
Oh my goodness.
Good way to deal with it. Well, the book. The Underhanded, it's out today, and Adam Sykes is our guest, and he's the writer, so thank you for coming on the show.
Alan, thank you, Gavin. Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure chatting with both of you.
Good to speak to you again, Mike.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.